Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty. And a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Hey guys, I'm taking a week off. This is one of my favorite episodes from the Canada Land archives. If you are new to the show, you may not have heard it. I will be back on Monday with a new episode. Thanks. Kate Beaton draws the comic Hark a Vagrant. A million people a month read this thing. Kate has a global audience for content that is like unabashedly and idiosyncratically Canadian. There are comic strips about John Diefenbaker and Laura Secord. It is stuff that you will remember from history class. Her work is so funny and weird, so beautifully drawn and lyrically drawn. I'm obviously a pretty big fan of Kate Beaton's, and this is just humiliating. I forgot to hit record when she sat down in the studio with me and we began our conversation. So we had a half hour of conversation that I missed. I haven't done that since my first year doing radio, but she was good enough to stick around with me, and the conversation only got better. So stick around. That is coming right up. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Stephen Murray, Stu Brown, Matthew Braga, Canock, Eric, Deborah Friedman, Matt Thomas, Matt Fairley, and Ethan Henry. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses. But we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter, like, seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get, like, anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding, like, the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand.
Do you have to go?
No. I can definitely talk to you about, but I will tell you the John Diefenbaker story.
Okay. We just did a half hour that wasn't recorded because I'm a chump.
That's okay. I showed up late.
All right. We were talking about John Diefenbaker.
Yeah. Is it on now?
We are now. You should probably hold the machine.
That's okay. Yeah, we're tit for tat now. So.
All right. Maybe we need to pause for 10 minutes for me to go and just like stare at the corner and feel. Yeah, okay.
That's totally fine.
Thank you, Kate.
And yeah. No, the story, like I said, I don't know if I remember it exactly, but he had the phone on his desk. And it was the phone to call the president, and it was just there. And it was, like, kind of obvious to anybody. And I think that he would point it out sometimes, like, that's the phone, like, the emergency phone. I can call Kennedy if I want to. And then when Pearson took office after him, he was kind of disgusted by it, maybe. And they put it away somewhere. They, like, put it in a closet.
Yeah.
And then one day it began to ring, and they couldn't find it. Which is pretty great. And then they finally found it. It was like the wrong number.
Wait, it was like the closet was ringing and it was Kennedy? Or
it was like in a drawer or a closet or something, and it was ringing and they couldn't find it, and because they were like, where's the phone? And no, it wasn't. It was a wrong number. But it was like, uh-huh, a wrong number on like this secret presidential line.
Uh-huh.
Which is like two totally different prime minister styles. And Diefenbaker and Kennedy didn't like each other.
That's right. You had LBJ and Pearson together, which is like, that's like a comic.
That, I mean, that was when he shook him by the lapels, when you read Charles Ritchie's diaries.
The treatment. He was giving him the LBJ treatment.
Yeah. You pissed on my doorstep.
Yeah.
Because he spoke out against the Vietnam War. I love that.
You got Pearson as like cool as a cucumber, like not as a nerd, but it's just like, hey, I don't rattle.
Yeah. Well, he was an aviator, and I love that people called him Mike because his I think it was his flying instructor who was like, Lester's a name for nerds. I'm going to call you Mike. And he was like, that's cool. I'm fine with that. He liked it when people called him Mike.
What is your audience like? Is it 60% American? 70%? Like, what is the...
Oh, it's just because of numbers of people, it's overwhelmingly American.
Yeah.
And then Canadian and British and... and then more in Europe and South America and that kind of thing. And when you are aware of that audience, as much as I love putting it, the Canadian stuff, you become also aware that everybody is inundated with American culture. But like, everybody wants to be represented. Everybody wants, yeah, to be seen in their way, because we've all watched Mel Gibson in The Patriot and other movies where like it's just like America.
Yeah. Well, we're sort of saying two different things. It's like everybody wants their own, you know, yeah, reference points, mm-hmm, to be represented. But they also, I think, are incredibly – if something is uniquely specific, if you're telling me something about like some, I don't know, historical New Zealand figure that you're that you're really fascinated with, I'm not going to say like, New Zealand, I'm not from there.
Yeah. Forget, yeah.
Like, sorry.
I think that there's just an appetite everywhere, even in America. Like, we're kind of being mean to America as if they can help the fact that they have this giant market on like culture. Like, there's an appetite out there for stories that are just good and for historical figures that were amazing and doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter where they're from.
I guess that's what you do, because you're not doing the biopic of Diefenbaker. You're kind of like dropping people right in the middle of some, I don't know, character quirk or some point of tension or some joke about people who the vast majority of your – of the hundreds of thousands of people who follow your work have never heard of this person before. But I guess they get to kind of like your enthusiasm and specific interest by proxy. They get to kind of sit in that and
– Yeah, for sure. And with the internet so close, they just Wikipedia it. Like right away.
Yeah.
And then it's all right there, all the information. And
do they? Do people like...
Oh, yeah. Like I get all the time that like my website and Wikipedia are open on the same like two double tabs. But it's great because you read the comic and then you read the like entry and then you come back and you get a bit more of the comic and it's kind of this immersive experience. And not only do I sort of teach people, but people teach me because... I always get requests for people, like, please do this person, please do this person. And every now and then you look something up and you're like, oh, that guy really is rad and he's cool. I like him. And I wouldn't have known that if I didn't have this giant readership who like is just excited by history and wants to see their favorite thing.
Right. You're like, that's like your play free bird.
Yeah. Do Jack Churchill. I can't tell you how many people have asked me to do Jack Churchill. And now I won't make a comic about him just because I can't.
Just out of sheer defiance.
Just no. Yeah. Because he's like a cartoon. Do you know who he is? He's a World War One soldier who went to war with like a bow and arrow. And there are pictures of him with his like bow and arrow.
Uh-huh.
And he was like such a soldier. You know, quotes for him are like the most machismo, like, I'm going to war because a man needs to like be a man and I have my bow and arrow and guns are for babies. And
so he's a propaganda. He's a poster boy.
Yeah, kind of. But he was also just like everyone, even at the time, everyone was like, wow, that guy's totally nuts. But
right. Also insane.
Because they're going to World War I with a bow and arrow.
In an era of industrialized warfare.
Yeah. Imagine being the guy who got hit by that and was just like, what? Like some German, poor German boy, like expecting to get shot, but he gets like an arrow in the chest.
Yeah, it's bad enough that you're dying. It's just like you're so confused.
You're dying confused and you're like, is this a joke? What's happening?
What you do is so specific, asking you to come here to talk about like, wow, you've kind of cracked the code of how to be creative on the internet, how to release your work for free and still make a living, how to do stuff that is uniquely Canadian but play to a global audience. And so it's like, well, tell me how you did it. And of course, what you did, like nobody who actually set out to do what you're doing.
Yeah, in a way you can't really set out to do anything. You have to do what you want to because when I started, everyone was like, she found like the formula or like I would get like you tapped into this niche audience and you're like, that's not what I was trying to do. I was just doing my thing.
Yeah. Which is maddening, by the way, because any other profession, people are like, well, no, this is how you do it.
How I do it. Yeah. And there is like you definitely become aware of this interest in trying to figure out what that magic formula is, especially in Canada, because I have been contacted from everything from Historic Minutes to the Museum of Civilization, which is now going to be the Museum of Canadian History.
The Heritage Minutes people called you?
Yeah. Well, they put out some new ones, right?
Uh-huh.
Like Harper gave them a bunch of money and was like, make a bunch of War of 1812 things because he was all weird about the War of 1812. I think it's because it's like a military part of Canada's history.
He can say that? He can tell them what to do it on? I guess he could do whatever he wants.
Well, they made some for the first time in like 20 years, like two or three new ones. And two of them, I think, were about the War of 1812 and one was about Confederation. The whole thing about 1812, I find kind of bizarre. There was this giant push for commemorating it and a lot of places were getting money. And when you read interviews with like museums and stuff, they were like, yeah, we got a lot of money. I don't know why. and it's just War of 1812 centennial.
Yeah.
When I worked at the Maritime Museum of BC, it was the last 2007. I just like fresh out of my history degree. And I was like, oh, museums is the way for me. The conservative government came in and slashed the Museum Assistance Fund in half, and it had been the same since the 70s.
Yeah.
And museums everywhere are struggling for money. So the whole 1812, like, money pile was just weird to me.
Well, it's because, I mean, there is this kind of version of Canadian history. Like, there's, like, some people said he's trying to rewrite it. And, like, the Franklin thing, these sort of kind of heroic Boy Scouty things.
Yeah,
that
that's also about Arctic sovereignty, right?
And it's about Arctic sovereignty and like oil, energy
oil
claims.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always, like, you're like, oh, that's great that there's so much money and government support for history. But it's only about these super specific things. Like, even at all during that 1812 time, if you picked up, like, the Canada's history, it used to be called the Beaver, it was almost always like Tecumseh.
Yeah.
Something on the cover, which is great because Tecumseh is
amazing.
What are
they now? I know that they changed it from the Beaver because
to Canada's history.
They were having all kinds of problems with Google searches.
You would.
Yeah.
It's a great magazine. I bought a subscription for my dad so I could come home on Christmas and like read all of them.
Right. Are you going to do – I want to see like a Kate Beaton Heritage Minute. Are you
– They'd be fun. I everybody's fond of Heritage Minutes in a way – that is different from other media. Like all the when we were you and I were talking before about movies like the Tommy Douglas Story and stuff that nobody really watched and people were like, eh, I don't care. because there was something weirdly sincere and straight to the point about those Heritage Minutes. They had to pack in the information they wanted you to learn, so it had to be like it was all just like super exposition and like unnatural dialogue and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
but we watched it as kids and we remembered everything, and I think that they did a lot for us, like our generation.
Yeah, yeah.
In knowing our own history, they were cheesy and stuff, but like I'd count them.
Laura Secord, what brings you here?
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah. And she's like, oh, the British, and her ear grows big. And she's like, so I got to go because I'm a spy, and like says it to the camera. Drunk History also. Drunk History is a good example because it's funny and it's kind of goofy, but it's also about how passionate those people are about the story that they're telling.
Yes.
They just happen to be really drunk. But
yeah.
They're like, you don't understand, like, Oney Judge was a hero. And
well, that's really interesting because what they remove is everything that's labored and earnest and propagandistic about relaying history. And it cuts to, like, if some drunk person is dying to tell you about this duel, it must be because they genuinely, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what comes across in your stuff. It's like, I'm not telling you this because I'm your history teacher.
Yeah.
You know,
or your government.
Yeah, or, that's right. Or like CBC's like, well, I guess we got to do a Tommy Douglas biopic.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like that's telling or Canadian stories.
I wonder what the impetus was behind that, actually.
Was that after the Greatest Canadian Thing?
I think it was. And that makes sense.
So they like, oh, well, this is the guy
like,
that everybody.
Oh, this is the one. But you got to have the passion for it.
And, yeah.
And that's really the key. Like when you're excited about something, other people are excited about it.
Yeah. I'm going to try to break it down. There is a formula to what you do. I'm going to try to break it down in a way that's going to be replicable to, you know, for my own selfish purposes and for anybody else out there, which is not that everybody should go and, like, study how to draw, like, Victorian dress or, you know. It's got to actually come from a genuine interest in your subject matter.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's an interesting balance between, like, I think that you feel, you know, a commitment to be good to your audience and to entertain them and to do stuff that's funny. Like, I think you're...
Yeah, well, you have to do that, too.
Yeah. Like, you are performing. You are playing for your audience. Mm-hmm. And yet you're also, like, it's a very personal exercise in playing to your own obsessions, you know?
Yeah.
Add the internet so that you have the capability, you have the potential to reach everybody, but so does everybody.
Yeah.
And so the more specific your work is... I think about things like The Office and how it's like, I'm glad that the British Office was about Slough.
Yeah.
You know, a god-awful suburb. And,
right.
You know, they did not try to universalize it in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. You know, and all these kind of things of like, well, we can't have it actually, I don't know, that like Wayne's World thing of like, we can't call it Scarborough. Like, everybody has to imagine it as their suburb.
Wayne's World was in Scarborough?
He grew up in Scarborough.
That makes total sense.
Does that like make it better or worse for you knowing?
No, I just never thought about where Wayne's World was. That makes absolute sense.
Am I on track?
You are. You are. We're like, it almost even comes back to that kind of universal, like write what you know type thing.
Sure. But as we were talking about when I was not recording, it's not about like disappearing for 10 years and doing that first novel thing of writing what you know in a garret. Like, I think that you've been kind of bold and just evolved in public and experiment in public, and, mm-hmm. and you know, people kind of get involved in your story that way. Like they want to see where what you're going to do next. And
yeah, they do. And it's funny because I started so early. I was like 23, maybe 22 when I started like the Live Journal.
Yeah.
And at that point, like there was no audience. There was just the other people making comics, and then the people who read those comics, and it just sort of grew organically. There was no like big push for an audience to show up. They just kind of rolled in through a link from here or a recommendation from a friend or like a reblog or a or whatever. Luckily, you know, me being able to do what I want to do, and that not everything that everybody wants to do is going to get an audience. It might be like their baby and they love it and it's amazing to them and it's exactly what they want to do, and it might not be the thing that gets an audience, like comics that are a bit too esoteric, and they'll have a following that's super into it but very small, and like an admiration from other places, but it's harder for them to like sell the t-shirts and make the money,
because when you're giving away the content for free and then living off of the ancillary advertising or merchandising stuff, then it is about scale, which is and that's where Canada is a unique place. If your stuff only appeals to Canadians, it's going to be a lot harder go.
It is. So I'm lucky that I have this larger audience, but I root for those Canadian projects. We want them to succeed. We want the good TV shows here. We want the things that really reflect who we are. It's just harder. Mm-hmm. And that said, it doesn't necessarily have to be. Why does a Canadian TV show have to just be in Canada? Like, why does it only have to appeal to a Canadian audience if it's just good television?
Yeah.
Which is probably, you know, what everybody thinks. I just... Unless you're, I mean, your show is called Canada Land. So.
Unless you're such an idiot that you would like overtly exclude.
Yeah, if my comic was called Hark a Canada, I don't know.
If you pitched, like if you had to pitch webcomics, if you needed to ask permission to do webcomics, though you were wise enough not to put Canada in the title, I think anybody would still reject your pitch.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to do, you know, gag strips about, you know, literary figures, Canadian historical figures, and obscure points of interest that, like, I just happen to be really into.
Yeah, people might not. But that's the thing. Like, there is no gatekeepers. You just put your stuff up and it might work out.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the magical thing about right now. And even in my experience, I've seen that there are people who, before they'll come knocking on your door, they want to see that you've made a name for yourself already. They feel safer working with you, knowing that you've built this audience already. You come with this, you bring all this to the table.
Yeah.
And the comic, like the comic website is kind of just like my flagship or my storefront where people look in and go, I like that.
Yeah. Like if you were to pitch some completely obscure sounding project, well, if we work with her, we're like, well, you know, she's got 100,000 followers on Twitter that she can promote this to. She's got a million people who read her every month. I guess she knows what she's doing.
And I'm pretty aware of the power that you have when you have like a lot of eyes on something. And when I started listening to your podcast, I like tweeted about it like 3 times. And I was like, link.
I appreciate it. Everybody go.
It ends up being a meritocracy in that way because, you know, you want to support the other people who are good and doing good things.
Yeah.
And if someone's doing a comic that I really like, I'm like, read this comic.
I think that it's really shifting our conception of an artist or of a creative person, of a communicator. But it's almost shifting it back. It's almost kind of like contrary to the auteur theory of creativity and puts it back in a, like, you know, I'm a vaudeville performer and I'm on 3 times a day. You can come see me and I'll be here and it's a nickel at the door.
Yeah.
You know, or like these genius cartoonists like Klaus and Ware who can disappear for years and like, what are they doing? You know, when's Ivan Brunetti's book going to come out? And then, you know, and then it's a literary event when it comes out versus the guys who inspired them who were like, in the paper every day, Charles Schulz, who is like decade after decade.
You
got to
respect
decade.
Those guys.
Yeah,
I mean, or like, I mean, even old time painting greats. You have they all had patronage from rich families in like Florence or something, right? So it.
And they had to.
Artists have always.
Paint portraits of them for that.
Yeah. I'd be like, I'll finish my masterpiece, but here's a picture of your kid.
Yeah. I'm sure you get no shortage of.
Lots of like, will you draw my wife? I'm going to propose or we're getting married or something. Yeah. But the newspaper comic guys, I've met quite a few of them and I really respect what they do.
Can we talk about being a woman on the internet? I mean, especially after this past summer with Gamergate, when women who work in video gaming were just so maliciously harassed. And I was thinking that, comics culture online, it's not so different. And there's a lot of bad behavior towards women in that culture, too.
The bad things that I have experienced are not – they just don't even hold a candle to the people who work in games or anything like that. And even mainstream comics. The funny thing about indie comics and web comics is they've always been pretty – woman friendly. Like you had even in the really early days, there was Robert Crumb, sure, but there were like the women's comics, however the weird way that they spelled it. And,
what was Tits and Clits? That was
or Alison Bechdel or whoever. She's been doing it for years and she's amazing, by the way.
Yeah.
We in the indie comics scene are like aware of it, but kind of a little bit off to the side. You're in it and you're not in it at the same time. I have to admit that I'm really used to the way that people talk about my work and my peers. At first it really jars you because I didn't grow up in the comic scene. I just sort of stumbled into it through like some side door. And so like the first time that I started getting like gendered commentary on my work or people saying things about me that were sexist, I was like, what the fuck? and now I don't really bat an eye because it's just there. It's like white noise.
Yeah.
And that's too bad. But it also makes your life better because if you in the end, you really learn that what you need to do is pick your battles because you can't take everybody on. And you only need to speak out when it matters the most,
mm-hmm.
because it's exhausting fighting that. I cringe every time I read a news article about Anita Sarkeesian or that whole Zoe Quinn thing.
Oh, God.
But like, just you're watching it and your mouth is open, and you're reading about what's happening, and it seems so unbelievable that there are no laws, that there are no protection, that there's like, it's just people being like, get a thicker skin while like, you know, your address is being posted online and stuff. But again, that's games. In comics,
I think that in some of those cases, there are laws. There's just no mechanism to enforce them or to track it back.
Or like
to,
it's not real because it's the internet. It's like the internet isn't part of everybody's lives completely.
I feel like we're kind of learning that, you know, the idea of who is a misogynist creep is was a bit wrongheaded, or at least it wasn't inclusive enough.
No.
Because if we thought it was like the jock.
Yeah.
It's the nerd.
The really mean nerds are the ones who cannot picture themselves as being a victim because they were victimized in their life.
Yeah.
Somehow. And they're like, I'm not mean because someone shoved me in a locker once or 100 times. They hate the idea of, you know, mea culpa. I messed up. I'm mean.
Yeah.
Because other people are mean.
There's that great 30 Rock where Tina Fey remembers herself as being this kind of abused geek. And then she goes back to her high school reunion. Everyone's like, you were always saying really harsh, snarky things about all of us. You were a bully.
But yeah, all that stuff is going to end because it just has to, because the content is in a lot of ways driven by the audience, and the audience is expanding and diversifying and maybe a bunch of jerks are going to go out kind of kicking and screaming, but they are going to be replaced by a bigger, more inclusive, more understanding audience. At least that's like, you got to hope for that.
I hope so. I have two minds about it. I mean, I was reading one essay about how this is a cultural war and the right people are winning, because every time Anita Sarkeesian is piled upon, she will earn $160,000. Because people support her. People will shove money and resources and support and bring to a higher level the people who are targeted. But like, that's not a great way of...
No,
a lot of people get hurt
because nobody wants to be those people.
Yeah.
And absolutely nobody on earth would like to trade places with those people.
Yeah, it's not worth
it. It doesn't matter if it's getting better for them.
Yeah.
And
she had to leave her home. I mean,
That's horrible.
I would guess that being a woman on the internet is a bit of a cakewalk compared to being a woman working in Fort McMurray in the oil sands, which I know you did for a couple of years. You were telling me a bit about that back when I thought I was taping and was not. I want to talk with you a bit about that, because to this conversation about telling Canadian stories and what sort of things we want to read about and what sort of things we want to see on the CBC and other channels and, you know, fictionalized or otherwise, that is the big Canadian story. That is the one. I am so interested in knowing more about it, like beyond the political controversy of it, the environmental conflict. I want to know just like, what is it like? Because it looks so extreme and you were there.
I believe that Fort McMurray is the most interesting and important thing that's going on here right now. I did a comic a few months ago because I might do a book about my experiences there.
Really?
And the comic was called Ducks, and it was about an environment that was hostile to everybody. I think that was the description that I put on it. The working in a place that was bad for an environment that included humans, because I was there, and when I left, I saw very little of the place that I knew in reports about the town or the mines or anything.
Because you were, you know, you had access that people don't get.
Yeah, yeah. Like you, if you go up there and you're like, I want to do a story, like you're not allowed on the sites, you're not allowed in the camps. There's no pictures. I have very little photographic record of there because, like, we were told that you weren't allowed to take pictures.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing, like you confiscate your camera and you're like, well, it's not like it's some kind of crazy, like, you know, CIA deal. It's just people digging up oil. But I found that was really lacking in the modern conversation is the human experience. There's a lot of conversation that is needed to go on about the environmental impact and that kind of thing, but very little about human beings working up there. And it covers all of Canada. That there were everywhere from Newfoundland to Vancouver Island.
Like, yeah.
There are workers making a living for themselves, and it right now it is like the pan-Canadian experience in a way. Because almost all of us know somebody who's working in the oil sands.
Yeah.
And in the East Coast especially, like, people in my town, if they're raising kids, the dad is likely, you know, on days off or on work, on shift and back. And it's a way of life that takes its toll on you, but everybody is up there trying to make a better life. Because that might be the option that they have, the maybe the only option. I don't know. I wanted to make a comic that told the story of what I saw, because I didn't see what I saw anywhere else except for, you know, in my memory.
Yeah.
And every now and then on the Facebook pages of the people that I used to work with, they were still up there. and it got an amazing response. I got so many letters from people who said things like, this is what I saw too, and I don't feel like I've seen it anywhere before, and like, it's not something that I can explain to people.
Yeah.
And it is hard to explain. Like, you work in that kind of environment, and then I didn't even know how to talk to people, really. And I felt like I'm crazy, but I talked to my cousin who worked up there and worked like overtime shifts upon shifts. And then he was like, and then I went to a bar with some of my friends, and they're all having a good time, and I just felt like I was outside of my body. I didn't know how to have a good time in a bar anymore. You can't really explain it.
Well, you were telling me earlier, like, being a camp and, like, all these guys from all over the country, and they're away from their homes and their families, yeah. And you were telling me you were, like, one woman to 50 guys.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just like picturing it's like aliens or something. Like it feels like it feels like, as you describe it, like going off to space or something.
Kind of, yeah. And like I said, like the main thing about being a woman there was that you were very obvious all the time. And you stuck out like a sore thumb everywhere. If you walked somewhere, people saw you. The sexual harassment or whatever was a part of my everyday. And you just got used to it in a weird way. My sister also worked there for a while. And we were in Halifax one time after we had both worked there. And one of the guys who we used to work with or was there came up to us and he talked to my sister. And he was like, oh, you used to work in this place. And she was like, yeah, yeah, I think I remember you. And he's like, yeah, like the guys and I used to like say. And then he just like talked how they used to talk about her, like in front of her. They're like, you know, we're like, oh, if we get a chance with her. And it was really like overtly like And she's like, oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. And and then he left, and our friends were like,
thanks.
Yeah, our friends were like, why did you let him talk to you like that? And she's like, oh, I don't know, because she just sort of like shut down and went to that place again where like, I deal with this all the time.
Right.
I'm just going to let it go, and then I'm going to go on with my day, because if I tell this guy, like, don't talk to me like that, he's not even going to understand why, because he doesn't know that he's saying, he doesn't even know there were those people, and there were the people who felt more comfortable around you because you were a woman, and maybe they thought of like they would open up to you a bit more, or they were kinder to you. People who are from my area generally like looked out for me a bit. They come in and check on me and see how I was doing. You know, if any of those assholes are bothering you, you just send them my way or whatever. Like,
you don't seem to kind of remember it as like purely this negative experience with these.
It was
awful
negative.
Men.
I mean, I didn't like it there.
Yeah.
And there were people who would put you in really uncomfortable situations. And there were bosses who didn't care. There were things that I just can't tell my mom about, you know, like the way that people talk about you.
Yeah.
And the way you hear it and the stares. There's no way to describe what it's like to just be trying to eat your lunch and have everybody just staring at you. And I know girls who quit because they couldn't deal with that kind of stuff.
It's like working in a jail or something.
Yeah, but like it was so complicated. Like when I've talked about being there and being a woman, like a lot of people are like, oh, I must have just everyone was just a bunch of brutes and they were all shitty and like, but it was more like everybody was lonely in their way, and sometimes they'd take it out on you,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes they would be your friend, and sometimes it was just like sadness and loneliness and stress and overwork manifesting itself in different ways. And you were caught in the fire of it a lot because you were this person that stuck out.
Like all of the things that men expect and ask women to be.
Yeah.
Including like a confidant or a shoulder to cry on or nurturing and everything else as well.
Sure.
At a ratio of 50 men to one woman.
Yeah. In a place that's like high stress, too much money, high divorce rates, frustration, you know, because people go up there to work and they get like yelled at by their bosses and stuff all day, and they have to like build this mine and make the money and everything, and it's enough to set everybody crazy. And I don't want to like I can only tell you things that I saw and that I went through, because there are people up there that don't mind it. And don't really have bad things to say. And I think of other people that worked there and how we all had our own little different forming Murray. Mm-hmm. And like there was a guy I know, his daughter worked there. She's tall and beautiful. And I think he went in the bathroom once and on the wall it was written her name and then should be worth the climb. And it's your daughter. And I don't know what he thought when he thought about her being up there. And I don't know what the guy thought, who a friend of mine who went through divorce when we were up there and he had to keep working, or anybody that I know who developed drug habits or things went sour on them one way or the other. Or all the young people who went there and thought they were just going to work for a while but are still there.
Yeah.
And everybody's got their own different thing. And mine is colored enormously different just because I was a woman there. And I'm not excusing anybody's bad behavior towards me or towards the other women there. But the longer that you stay, the more that you understand that nothing is black and white, that it's all just shades of gray.
The conversation becomes so often about whether it's just sort of like this evil hell on earth based on the environmental devastation, or whether it's, you know, Rex Murphy, it's renewing Confederation, it's the most wonderful place in Canada. Mm. And it, I'm just it sounds like it's just the most extreme place, and that everybody is just living these
big
extremities
money,
there. You know?
Big trucks.
Yeah, the work is big, the money is big.
Yeah,
the weather is big and trying to kill you. And,
yeah, and the like long days, and then the long nights. You're up there so up north so high that the days are really short in the wintertime and really long in the summertime.
Yeah.
The temperatures are very extreme, and like I worked on 3 or 4 different sites, different companies. I lived in the camps and I lived in the town, and the memories that I have that are the most like intense are the physical ones of like standing and waiting in the cold for a bus that was going to pick us all up at 4 a.m. and you're just standing there with like stomping your feet on the ground, and that kind of like very like in the moment physicality of the place, which is harsh and extreme. And people died up there.
Yeah.
And that's a reality. The biggest news story to leave Fort McMurray from the time that I was there was the time that 1,500 ducks flew into a tailings pond at Syncrude and were full of oil and drowned.
Right.
And it made national news, and Greenpeace showed up and everything, and it was everywhere. It was a huge scandal. When I left, everyone was like, oh, the ducks, and that's what everybody knew about. But, like, people I knew, people died.
Yeah.
And nobody hears about them. They even call it the shadow population. For a long time, I was like, I'm not ready to make a comic of this. I'm not ready to tell that story, because I didn't feel like it was even my right to do that, to be one of those people who were like, I was in the trenches and I saw horrible things. But
you can always say what you saw.
Yeah,
you know?
that's all I can say is what I saw.
Yeah. What I want to ask you before you go.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you still live here? Why do you?
Why?
Why'd you come back? Why do you live in Canada?
Canada is my home. I think New York was an amazing place to be for a while for an artist, because everybody there is working really hard. And you can't not like get caught up in that tidal wave of energy where you're like, I gotta do these things, and I meet these people, and the publishing people are there, and I got my agent there and stuff. But I will probably eventually go back to Nova Scotia, because it's just my home.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a lot of Canadians in the States who are super happy, and I was happy there too, but this is where I belong.
That is your Canada Land show. I hope you enjoyed it. You can email me. I read them all. I respond when I can. I am at jesse@jessebrown.ca. I am on Twitter @jessebrown. The website for this show is canadalandshow.com. And the crowdfunding page is patreon.com/canadaland. I produce this show with Christopher DeMello, and we will have the next episode for you up on Monday. If you like Canada Land, support it.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.